Morehead State University, 1925 to 1950, an oral history interview. Today we're interviewing Dan Preston, and the interviewer is Bob McLeod, 17 February 1984. Dan, where was your home originally?
In Bangor, Wisconsin, about 16 miles east of La Crosse.
How in the world do you get from Bangor to Morehead?
At that time, we went on the NP.
I was wondering more, Dan, how did a fellow who went to high school in Bangor, Wisconsin, how did he end up being the music director at Morehead?
Well, the route was rather circuitous. I had to go to college at Lawrence University at Appleton, Wisconsin, and on my graduation in 1918, I contacted President Weld of Morehead Normal, and the time was arranged. But my original plan in going to college was to become a forest ranger, because I had spent my teenage years mostly in the woods, trapping and fishing and hunting. And but my high school was so lacking in any scientific equipment that I had no preparation for the chemistry course that was involved with forestry. And I flunked it flat. And a professor told me, "Dan, you'll never make it here. You better change your major." And but prior to that, my mother had required that I learn to play the violin, which I began studying at the age of 9, and it was continued until I graduated from high school. So I was a fair violinist to begin with. I went down to the music school at Lawrence to inquire if musicians were employable. And that was then to take the place of my forestry degree. I decided to go into music because they said they couldn't train enough of them to fill the need at that time. And so that is how I came to be in a position to contact the Morehead State Normal School for a position.
And you say it was Dr. Weld that you contacted.
Dr. Frank Weld, yes.
What happened next?
Well, before I could come to work at Morehead, I was drawn into the Army and was there until the last part of December. During the armistice, or just immediately after, I learned that it was possible to be employed at once. I wouldn't have to wait a long time to be mustered out of the service if I had a job. So I called, wired Dr. Weld to find out if he could still use me. And the wire in reply said report for work on January 7th. And that is how I arrived in Morehead.
Okay, now, was this your first trip to Morehead after the war was over?
Yes.
What were your impressions of Morehead?
I had grown up in an area that was just back from the Mississippi River, so there were many valleys, many hills, and then when I got off the train at Morehead and saw nothing but horizon miles and miles away, I wrote to my wife and said, "If I can stay in this flat place until spring, I'll consider it fortunate."
How did you get from the depot to the campus?
I walked.
Oh, you walked. There wasn't any other transportation available.
At least I couldn't find any.
What did the campus look like at that time?
Well, there were, it was a small, very small campus. Weld Hall was almost new. There was no work done on the grounds yet. The old main hall that burned was there. with an addition which was called the training school, and two dormitories for girls.
Where did the men? Where did they house the men at that time?
They must have obtained rooms in homes. There was no other place for them to. Nothing like a dormitory for them.
And President Weld was the president at that time?
That's right.
Who were some of the other faculty people that you remember?
Cass Ballard was science. And it's hard to recall. That's a long time ago. Slev Nimzik was a student.
Sliv was a student who later became the football coach. Do you have any impressions of Cass Ballard?
Yes, very definitely. He was one of the most alert teachers in a college level that I've ever known. He had a history of teaching, an experience that was rare. He had served as a county superintendent in the county where Alexandria is located. And he told many interesting stories about how at that time rural teachers obtained their jobs by bidding for them. And one girl he told me about got a job for $35 a month if they would provide her an unabridged dictionary, carry all the water for drinking, and build the fires. And a young man came along and said he would do it for $25 a month. They wouldn't need a dictionary, and he'd do all of the chore work.
The teacher negotiations are a little different now, I guess.
Yeah.
you mentioned Maud Hayes. Can you tell us a little more?
Yes, she was a very superior teacher of speech and director of the theater. If I remember correctly, the interest in the theater at Morehead State was on a par with what it is now under Delmer Hansen.
Well, it seems that the faculty members you mentioned were very high in quality, and that Morehead State has had that attribute for all these years. Really look for the highest.
I think that is true, because on one occasion I was discussing educational problems with the superintendent of music in the city of Seattle, and they had hired one of our graduates here from Morehead State to take care of their woodworking shop. And he said, well, the experience I've had with Morehead graduates, we're going to run a pipeline right back there.
How about some of the students of that period? Do you remember any of those?
Yes, I do. Not too many by name, but Arthur Storms was one of the first ones to return from World War I and begin his college career, or continue it. And there were three brothers that lived in Moorhead, the Gates boys, Ernie Gates and Dewey. I can't think of the other one's name.
You were at Morehead State then, from 1919 until 1948.
That is right.
Could you tell us about the curriculum as you saw it, as it changed over the period?
Well, the curriculum has, of course, become very much broader. But at the time, at that early date, the music curriculum is the only curriculum I can speak about, but we were permitted to build up a curriculum that was pointed toward performing and not so much the teaching of methods. It was our notion that the performing on a violin and a piano and singing required so much time and preparation that they surely could do some teaching with their experience, at least with a limited amount of appreciation.
Did you have some performing groups during that period?
We had the outstanding group was a group of eight boys that came together in 1928. They were called a double quartet. Two of them were music students. The others were in various fields. Very important people like Reuben Parsons was one of them. And Oscar Thompson, all of these boys went on to be college teachers. That is those two. And the musicians became very well known. Robert Walls, for example, after teaching 1 year in high school, went to Valley City to have the college choirs. Then he went to Idaho to have the college choirs there. Then he became the chairman of the department at Oregon State, where he retired about 5 years ago.
The double quartet was the first of these
groups. They achieved some distinction through their trips out of the area, several times to Chicago for our national conventions of educators and musicians, for Kiwanis Club conventions in Regina, and the likes. They were well known.
There was another large group that developed shortly after your double quartet, the Amphion Chorus. Could you tell us about the Amphion Chorus?
Just following the very memorable closing of banks in 29, our economy in the country did not respond at once at all, and many organizations became disorganized, one of which was a male chorus called the Gideon Singing Society in Fargo. They broke up, and a member of that group came over to ask me if I would conduct another male chorus, if one could be gotten together. And I told him that I would expect a community chorus to be really representative, and they should not limit membership to just people here, and they didn't. They came from all over this area, outside of Moorhead and Fargo, as well as in town. On the first meeting, they had 125 men. I told Mr. Caldwell that since I was a member of the community and wished to share in community affairs, that if these men would oblige themselves to attend rehearsals regularly, I would be willing to do the same thing and do my work for nothing. But they would have to agree to perform one concert at least a year, and then see what would happen after that. As a result of that, the choir became quite a well-known choir. Their first outside appearance was at the World's Fair in Chicago, where they did well enough to encourage us to anticipate something greater. And in 1936, they sang at Town Hall in New York and Academy of Music in Philadelphia, Orchestra Hall in Chicago. But they did one thing for the community that is, I think, of some importance. They were successful in getting the colleges to put their funds for artist courses into a common fund that was administered by the Amphion Chorus Board. So the Amphion, with the assistance of the colleges, were able to bring to Fargo and Moorhead at least 50 of the world's very greatest performers, including the quartets, string quartets, and symphony orchestras, and Brailovsky, the great pianist, and Stern, and artists of that caliber. So the wonderful musical atmosphere in Fargo and Moorhead at the present time may well have been found its roots during the 1930s when the Amphion and the colleges collaborated in bringing artists to the area.
You mentioned earlier that when you were visiting with Saul Hurok in New York, a little story about the Russian singers.
Yes, that was interesting. In 1927, my wife and I were in New York to get artists for Moorhead State artist series. And I asked Hurok if he had any male groups that could that were available. The reason being, I wanted the boys on our campus to hear an excellent male singing group, and from there on, perhaps organize one of their own. That, incidentally, was the beginning point for the boys who decided to come together as the double quartet. But Hurok told me of the Kedrov Quartet, four men who were voice teachers, or had been before the Bolshevik Revolution. They had been voice teachers at the National Conservatory of Music in St. Petersburg, Russia. And they were now available for concerts. And I said, well, let's bring them to Moorhead. And they were, Moorhead was the second concert they gave in the United States. When Nikolai, the leader of the group and the head of the voice department, came into my office in Weld Hall, he noticed a bass violin standing in the corner. He walked over to it and plucked the lowest string on that bass and sang a note or two. I asked him then, Mr. Kedrov, how do the Russian basses achieve such a bass voice? He replied, it's resonance, my boy. And I asked him if he would then tell me how to achieve that kind of resonance. So he worked with me about 3 hours, and I discovered that the upper lip, if you can keep it stiff for singing as well as for everything else, it will work pretty good. The stiff upper lip is the secret.
Going back to the Amphion chorus, after your trips to the various places in the United States, I understand that there was a trip scheduled in Europe.
Yes, when we sang in Town Hall, a Swiss by the name of Albert Morini, who was an international booker of artists, heard us, and he came out to Moorhead to discuss the possibility of a tour of Europe. And so at that time, one was arranged for the summer of 1941. We had 18 concerts booked in Paris and Rome and in England and Germany. And the trip, though, was never did mature because there was a conflict. Mr. Hitler's army was in Paris at the time. We were to have given two concerts under the sponsorship of Alexander Bullitt, who was then our ambassador there, our consul.
You taught at Moorhead State during some very distinct times, like the early 20s, the Depression years and the war years. I'd like to ask you your impression of the students and how the university, or at that time the college, survived the Depression years.
if I recall the attitude of students, they were all more serious then. They were not so addicted to being entertained. They worked a little bit more for an educational purpose rather than an all-around personality that could play and work and enjoy life freely. And that was true in the early 20s. That was after World War I. And then the Depression came in the 30s. And there again, funds were determined the attitude of most everyone, not just simply students, but having gone through these many years, I've been in a teaching relationship with people for 65 years. Those two periods, the early 20s and all of the 30s, remain in my mind as the most steady years in, with regard to the attitudes of people. There was not so much confusion. Everyone had a goal to aim for.
I imagine some of the people that were going to school and singing in your various musical groups would use this experience to raise money by performing in the surrounding area. And if that's true, could you tell us about any of those groups?
Yes, the students who were instrumentalists did a lot of performing in the area for pay, and four of them were the first students that Lawrence Welk put in his big orchestra. They were with Welk for some time, Jules Herman and St. Paul and Dale Halleck and Reno, Joe Best and Phoenix. And so they had a lot of experience professionally before they quit the concert hall and went into teaching.
Going to the next period of time, World War II, and I know that had some vast implications for the campus, but could you describe your implications at that time?
Yeah, World War II was a period of disaster in every way. The choirs in all campuses, I'm sure, suffered greatly because the boys were taken into the service. And so what had been going on a number of years routinely now had to change all of a sudden, and no one knew for how long. I had a choir here at Morehead State of about 48 voices. And as far as I know, there were only two boys left on the campus who were part of that group. The rest of them all went to service.
So the population or the enrollment became pretty much dominated by the women at that time.
That's right, it did. I can't recall just whether people were happy and delighted with things. I'm sure they weren't, but everyone did their work, though.
When the Air Force moved some people in here for training, did those people participate in the choir and some of the other extracurricular activities?
No, they did not. They were strictly contained in their own units.
Dan, after these some 65 years of teaching music, what kind of thoughts do you have on it now in retrospect?
My experience with young boys and young girls from in the elementary grades included working particularly with boys' voices. And I discovered that they reacted to formal training easily, perhaps more so than an adult, because they had no bad habits to overcome, merely to create new ones. And so I began working with young boys from 9 years and older here at the campus. We had two or three boys' choirs that developed excellent voices. And then later on, I had groups that traveled. They were stationed in Oregon. And one important thing physically I discovered with the training of boys' voices until they were old enough to grow into adulthood was their voices are not likely to change because they develop their singing voice resonated by the head rather than by the pharynx. And so just for a practical reason, it's good for boys to learn how to sing and to start early so that they have the advantage of their vocal muscles growing with the rest of the body instead of having to do that strange thing of voice change when they're 12, 13, and 14. Those boys, if they are trained to sing, are not likely to have a voice change. They will become adult men in graduated stages until they drop from a high soprano to a tenor or a baritone or a bass. So I'm eager to share that information with any group that could use it, and particularly I'm interested in helping churches stabilize their senior choirs by having the young people, 9 years and older, learn how to become singers after with a kind of a scientific background. And that program is nothing but a dream at the present moment, but I'm trying to find a way to sow the seed and let it grow from there. And then, of course, having taught 65 years, I'm not exactly a kid anymore, and I hate to call myself a senior citizen because I don't feel like that. But I do know they can sing, and so presently I'm trying to promote an idea that a senior citizens chorus could provide interesting and a happy background for people who are no longer connected with the markets and law offices and such as that. If that gets off the ground, I'll be very glad because I think it can help them.
Dan, you left Moorhead State in 1948. What happened to your professional career at that time?
I went to the University of Washington at Seattle to complete my work for a doctoral degree. And that was 1948 to 49. During that time, one of Moorhead graduates was the head of music at Olympic Junior College in Bremerton. And Larry Peterson offered me a job to teach voice over there while I was working on my doctorate at the university. During that time, another former student who had, Robert Walls, who had become the chairman of music at Oregon State University, guided a committee at Forest Grove, Oregon, who were looking for a dean for Pacific University's School of Music. Walls directed the president to me at Seattle. So the consequence was I became a dean of music at Pacific University in Forest Grove, Oregon. And I was there from 1949 to 1963.
Was it easier being a dean than the teacher here at Moorhead State?
Well, it required quite a different experience. As a dean, I became involved in traveling about the states of Oregon and Washington and California and Idaho, contacting high schools and trying to put together a student body of musicians that were extremely capable. At Pacific, I had the authority to grant very sizable scholarships. If I found a superior musician, I could give him a full scholarship. And with that authority, I was able to put together a student body that became very, very successful in their performances.
When did you leave that job, Dan?
I retired from Pacific in 1962, but I came to back to Fargo in 1963. Mrs. Preston had passed away in 1962, and I came back to the Midwest to become a vocal consultant for the Episcopal Diocese of North Dakota. And in that position, I was able to meet with several churches in the state before the position was disbanded.
You just couldn't wait to get back to the flat country, huh?
Well, I had a real reason for coming back here. My children never did leave this area, and so I needed to be back where they were. However, one of my sons, Bill, the youngest one, is still teaching in the School of Optometry at Pacific University. But most of my children, two of them, one in Cormorant Lake and another in Minneapolis and one in Grand Forks.
Did any of them follow you in the musical profession?
Yes, Jim and Grand Forks has been a teacher of music in the system there for a number of years. He'll retire in another year. And Molly, who is Mrs. Claire Flood, lives in Hawaii and out near Honolulu. She has a degree in music, but she married a professional soldier and has been a resident of the world, you might say, in Japan and Germany and elsewhere.
Well, Dan, I know that you've, since your retirement, you've been very actively involved in teaching students yet, and I've had a hard time running you down over the last few months because of all the lessons you're giving and everything else. I want to thank you for taking the time to come over and visit with us today.
It's been a real pleasure, Bob.
And
it, it